All right, everybody. Hello, good evening, good afternoon, good morning, whenever, however you're listening to this. I'm very, very excited for today's show. I'm not quite so excited for the weather. We were talking about this backstage, and we might touch on this a little bit, but there's a lot to talk about because it is the first 2 days of Trump's presidency, and I'm kind of glad to have been very wrong in a lot of respects. And maybe this will be my show to take a lot of lickings for that. But I think I speak for everybody collectively when I say we could all use a little bit of that global warming right about now, because on the way in to work for me this morning, it was negative 13 degrees. So, and my guest today, he's way, 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 way down south. And I know for them, anything below 60 degrees, and they have everything that can keep them thermally warm in their arsenal out. So, but you guys didn't hear me come here today to hear me talk about the weather and all that stuff. But before we get into today's conversation, go to all the links below where you can find my guest, myself, everything he's got going on, everything I got going on. Tiger Fitness through the link below, or tigerfitness.com/KyleM to go to Tiger Fitness to get the supplements that I use. As you can see, all the stuff back here. They just released a new flavor of Ruckus, which is an awesome pre-workout flavor. Make sure you go check that out. And I know I'm going to be getting that sooner or later. Deemed fit through the link below. Sarah M25 to get a discount, support first responders, and of course Fox and Sons Coffee to get some fantastic coffee. And without further ado, let's get right into it.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
And good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever, however, everybody's listening. I would like to welcome to the show, Mr. Warren McIntyre. How you doing, man?
Doing great, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. I like the tag along the name there, because I was just thinking about that as the introduction or something, like Tapper of Signs.
Yeah, I think I left that in there last time I was in someone's stream yard, but there you go.
Yeah, you know what, it works. And look, we got a mutual friend in the chat here, Red Hawk. Good to see you, man.
Oh, Red Hawk.
Oh yeah, he's awesome. So why don't you tell my audience who you are and kind of what you do, other than tapping signs?
Sure. I'm Warren McIntyre. I have a show over on The Blaze, and I do a lot of tweeting. I've got a book out called The Total State. I talk a lot about politics, obviously, specifically I focus on political theory. I'll do a lot of work on Italian elite theory, and so that is usually what I'm known for, kind of breaking down the mechanics of power for people on the right, because that wasn't something that was doing a lot, being done a lot in the mainstream when I kind of got started.
Yeah, and I think that's something where myself coming from more of a libertarian background, and I wouldn't say I'm necessarily completely out of that camp, but I would say I probably still have one somewhat well-positioned foot in that camp. But I'm kind of looking out at the world around me and listening to people like you, Red Hawk, the guys from the Old Glory Club, Pete Quinones, and all them. And not necessarily entirely changing the way that I view the world, but kind of coming to realize that live and let live isn't quite a perfect philosophy when you have the multifaceted of issues that we have today.
The libertarian to neo-reaction pipeline is a well-trodden path. That's where everyone started. So it's a good company. Many people to help you along the way.
Yeah, of course. Well, you know what? One thing I wanted to ask you about is, of course, Trump. Yeah, it's okay. You'll get there soon, or slowly but surely. Over the last year, it was really, really interesting for me, because I looked at Trump's campaign when he was first kind of getting back into seriously running, and it seemed like everything before July was pretty low energy and kind of like, I don't know if Trump has what it takes to do, what it actually takes to do something this time. And then, of course, July 13th, you know, 45 minutes away from me, happens. And it seemed like his campaign had completely flipped on its head. So I kind of wanted your opinion on how this all kind of came to fruition over the last like year and a half of Trump's campaign and kind of how you saw it.
Well, you know, a lot of people were looking at the primary and they were saying DeSantis is the guy, right? And I live in Florida. I love Ron DeSantis. Like a lot of DeSantis guys get this mixed up. You know, I highly respect the guy. He literally changed my life due to COVID. Like the way he responded meant that I lived a drastically different existence than many people across the United States. Like he's an awesome governor. And when you look at his record, it on paper, it makes sense. Like, you know, obviously the problem with Trump was the execution, and look at this guy. He can kind of battle with the media. You know, he can push the envelope, but he's got the ability to get the job done. Right. That was kind of the rhetoric. But the thing that I tried to explain to a lot of my friends and coworkers and others was that ultimately, you know, Trump was kind of on a date with destiny. And that sounds dumb, I guess, if you're like a super materialist or whatever, but I'm not, so I don't care. There's a narrative that arc that had to be sealed. I also knew a lot of Trump supporters, you know, personally in my real life. They had a lot of, kind of older Trump supporters. And people did not understand the shift that had occurred on the right after the Trump presidency. Before, these people were GOP voters. Now they were Trump voters. Like all the worst, fears of National Review and all these guys, like Trump's a cult of personality. He's going to take over the party. Yeah, that's exactly what happened for the better, because the GOP was terrible. Like Trump isn't perfect, but the GOP needed to be destroyed. And Trump more or less did that. Like there's still, a establishment that you've got to fight with. You still got Mitch McConnell around, but ultimately Trump transformed kind of the conservative movement in a pretty radical way. And there's just no way that these guys were going to switch over to DeSantis, even though they love DeSantis. Like all these people, like even in his own state, like his own voters didn't want to vote for him over Trump, even though they, you know, thought he was amazing. And so Trump was having all the legal problems. It looked like he was out of energy, like you said, but then obviously you saw what happened with the assassination attempt. And I mean, what can you say other than the mandate of heaven is the most important mandate? That, you know, there was a miracle on stage. The man looked up at an immigration chart and the bullet missed him by, you know, centimeters, or, you know, missed his brain by centimeters. It hit him. But I think that really is a moment in which, yeah, I know Trump would have learned things. I know that his team would have been better no matter what. But that, I think, galvanized him, right? That was definitely a forging fire. And at that moment, you've kind of got to make a decision. Like, people are literally trying to murder you for what they think you're going to do. So are you going to do it or not, right? Like, are you, you know, what's the point of holding back? What's the point of trying to win favor? These people are literally trying to kill you on stage. They want to splatter your brains on TV for the entire world to see. So you better make it worth it, right? And I think that was really the moment that everyone saw the momentum shift. They saw his mentality shift, his energy shift. We were talking about the Nixonian blowout, you know, that was going to come with the second term. Now people started to doubt. They started to buy into the Kamala hype. I mean, it looks adorable now, right? But like that was a real thing at the moment. But ultimately, we did see, you know, him come in with the mandate, come in with the popular vote, come in with the Electoral College win, all across the board, along with, you know, the entire House, you know, House and Senate. So truly a one of the most amazing momentum swings in political history.
Yeah. And, you know, much to your point, I was very, very skeptical of Trump this time around, because I kind of looked at his first 4 years and it really seemed like he didn't have what it took. He much would have rather been liked by everybody and try to make friends, even with people who clearly hated him and didn't have his best interest in mind or his base's best interest in mind. And, you know, still even on his campaign early on, he was still trying to placate those kind of people. And then, like you said, I think it was after, you know, getting the mandate from heaven, so to speak. I think it seemed like he was much more serious, but even up until he got elected, I'm like, I don't know if he's going to do, you know, if he has what it takes, but then, you know, all the executive orders, and it seems like he means business this time around. So I'm holding off on pure optimism, but I'm getting a little bit of the bug.
Well, it's one of those things where was Trump perfect? Of course not. Like, he's a deeply flawed guy across the board, right? But I am a notable democracy disrespecter, right? Like, I have very little faith in that mode of governance. I don't think it does a good job. I think it basically kind of dooms your society to, you know, degradation. So I was never, you know, like, well, what I need is the most effective Democratic politician. Like, that was just never the solution for me. So the only solution really was, who is the biggest disruptor, right? And it's not so much what Trump was going to do for me, but the way in which the media was going to blow itself up, the way that the establishment was going to blow itself up trying to stop him. And they sure did, right? Like, they shredded every piece of credibility that they had left, which wasn't much, but they threw all of it into the fire, and just none of it works anymore, man. Like, Elon Musk did the old Roman on stage and nobody cares. Like, the left's trying to make it a thing and just nobody cares. It just doesn't matter. You can actually see the life just drain out of, you know, of them. They have no power and they know it, and it's just driving them nuts. But also, like, they're just so weak and they've lost. So, you know, it's great that Trump followed through. I'm extremely happy with the first couple days. And you're right, of course, like, he could blow it up, he could fail, he could lose focus. I just read a piece on this. It's going to go up on The Blaze tomorrow, probably. You know, like, it's still critical. Like, everything that's done with an executive order can be undone with an executive order. There is still a mountain to climb. But the fact that he came out of the blocks the way he did just kind of showed everybody, like, no, this really is the, you know, where it's at. He could still fail, but I mean, what do you want? Like, if the last 3 days don't put out a statement of intent for you, then I don't know what would.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it was kind of like the first day when he started, you know, it seemed like he was actually serious about mobilizing towards the border, foreign policy stuff, which is obviously very, very important to me. I couldn't have been happier to be wrong in this respect, because I think most people probably looked at his position on Israel and, you know, obviously taking a lot of money from Miriam Adelson. They're like, oh, you know what? This Gaza situation is just going to continue to get worse. And I think that was reasonable given the facts beforehand. But then literally as president-elect, he gets a ceasefire, which nobody had ever seen. And I, you might have heard about it, but I can't remember who it was. His envoy to the Middle East, Stephen Witkoff, I think his name was, had said, I don't care about the Shabbat. I'm coming and we're going to work out this ceasefire deal. So that was kind of like the first hint for me. Like, he actually seems serious this time, because no, you know, president in recent memory has ever said, like, no. We're cleaning this up. And, you know, I guess the flip side of that is that Trump probably looked at that and was like, this is kind of a disaster and I really don't want this on my watch. So we got to figure out something here.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as I've said about 1,000 times at this point, you know, Israel is its own nation. It has a right to do what it wants over there. I just want absolutely zero part in it. I don't want a single American dollar and a single American boot on the soil or a single American weapon involved. I may approve or disapprove of the way they conduct themselves, but ultimately that's just not my business. Like, I'm not the world's policeman, and I really am not going to spend my time pretending like I lose sleep every night over the fate of the Palestinian people. I hope they don't get killed. That seems awful, but ultimately, like, this is just not my problem. And that needs to be, you know, the default. And the beautiful thing about kind of the fact that the pro-war right was more or less broken over the Ukraine war really set us up for this, because even after October 7th, of course, you had kind of the reflex action of, we got to get involved. But you could kind of see there was a little bit of difficulty, because a lot, especially everyone under like 40, was just like, wait, man, we just had this debate. We're the right now. We're the anti-war party. Like, that's who we are. What are we doing here? And so I think ultimately, you know, while there's obviously a lot of momentum, you know, there's a lot of money and influence still tied up with Israel and its lobby and everything else, the people who really deeply care about this are, you know, they're kind of dying. And, you know, the people who are coming up don't care. And so you really are losing that momentum. So is America still going to be involved with Israel to some level? Yeah, probably. But like the ridiculous level that we've been before, probably not. We're probably moving away from this. And I think that's just healthy for everybody.
Yeah, and I think that's something that even a lot of left-leaning people, specifically anti-imperialist left people, that I'm very, very good friends with would agree with. And I think a lot of the more younger right-wing faces are kind of looking in the same direction, because it's like, look, over the last 20 years, if you can't see that the Middle East is just a disaster that the U.S. has no idea and shouldn't be involved with, then like, I don't know what to tell you at this point, because clearly that's all been very, very failed policy. So one other thing that I kind of wanted to go back to a little bit was kind of looking at DeSantis and Trump. It almost seems like more of the conservative energy was behind DeSantis. And when I when I say conservative, I mean like literal conservatives, whereas Trump was more of like just, you know, the general right-wing culture, not conservatives in particular. And you kind of walked around this point a little bit earlier, but DeSantis was very effective at using power, whereas I think a lot of people looked at Trump in his first 4 years and thought maybe he wasn't as good at using power. But now, obviously, that seems to have changed. What do you think about that dichotomy between conservative, you know, maybe you could say conservative ink, and kind of like the right wing base?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, of course, I'm not even a fan of the word conservative. You know, I don't think that that accurately describes what we should be doing. But to the extent that it is used, of course, I use it because, you know, that's the lingo to tag people. I think that it's very right to notice that the vast majority of people who are embracing DeSantis were establishment people. Like, you know, the National Review is like, he's going after Disney. We love corporations. You can't do that. But the vast majority of the people who were pushing for DeSantis were really those that were hoping he would be the controllable Trump, right? Like that was the thing. It's Trump, but we can keep the leash on him, right? And that was the hope. Like I said, a lot of people I know, you know, like diehard, you know, Rush Limbaugh listeners for 30 years, yeah, they would have laid down in traffic for Trump. You know, that was kind of the dichotomy there. So I don't think it was so much about the effectiveness. I'm sure some people, like, you know, you look at somebody like Chris Rufo, he really cares about the way in which DeSantis wields power. And so I think he probably genuinely saw that as an advantage. But ultimately, I think for most of the establishment conservatives, the thing they thought that was good about Ron DeSantis is that they could control him. And that Trump was too much of a loose cannon. He had too much of a personality behind him. He was drawing the loyalty away from them and kind of remaking the party in his image. And so ultimately, like, that's why they were against him. It wasn't about issues of effectiveness. Because if it was, like, that would have been a better argument. Like I said, there's nothing incorrect about the way people observed Ron DeSantis's action. But it's also a very different dynamic, because Ron DeSantis is established a power base in Florida. Like, he's not fighting the deep state. He is the deep state in Florida, like, in the best way possible. And again, love it. It's amazing. And there's a reason that, like, half of Trump's cabinet's from Florida. Like, he's, you know, he's pulling the farm team hard here, right? So you know, that these guys should always have been working together. They never should have been at odds. That's why from the very minute DeSantis announced his candidacy, I'm like, no, man, don't do this. Like, you're walking into a buzzsaw. Just wait your turn, you know. And ultimately, it looks like, you know, now J.D. Vance is the guy who's kind of, you know, the heir apparent. And again, I really like J.D. Vance. So I'm happy for once in my life as a guy on the right to have an embarrassment of options. You know, there's multiple guys for once that seem like they could really do the job and do it well and be effective. What an amazing problem to have for basically the first time I've ever seen it.
Well, and another thing that was important about Trump winning this time as well, kind of to your point, is that it almost seems like he's handing over power to the next generation, if you will, because J.D. Vance is what, like late 30s, early 40s, if I remember correctly. And then, you know, Jay Bhattacharya and some of his other picks, Tulsi Gabbard, Kash Patel, all these people are like millennials, or what would they be, like late Gen Xers or something like that. They're all people that aren't boomers, because, I mean, let's face it, over the last 20 years, pretty much most of the candidates, you know, more on the right and then maybe even the left, were mostly older people, the boomer generation that just will not give up all the power and, you know, pass the torch on to the next generation. I thought that was very, very interesting. What do you think?
Yeah, the generational shift, I mean, in some sense, it has to happen. Like, you know, Trump is what, he's like 81 or 82. There are no more boomers to hand power to. Like, you know, like you're going to need a guy in an iron lung, you know, to be able to hand the power to anyone else. So in some sense, it was just, it had to happen. But also, yeah, like there is a, it feels like, you know, guys like J.D. Vance and guys like Ron DeSantis are young and hungry, and they are coming from a different style. They don't believe that they have to be kind of the graceful losers. It's not about beautiful losers. It's, you know, we wield power, we win, we make changes. We aren't afraid to push back against some of these classic things. Probably a little more Vance now on that than DeSantis, even though I think, again, DeSantis is really good. Vance, DeSantis still holds on to many of kind of the traditional, or I shouldn't say traditional because it's really only in the last couple, you know, decades, but kind of the neocon instincts in a way that that I think Vance has largely eschewed. And so ultimately, I think, again, it's just a good mixture, but it is definitely a great thing to see the younger generation actually coming in and making a difference. It really, many of the attitudes that we are angry about on the inside the conservative movement are very much attached to the generation that has been running it. And we can literally just see the attitude shift the minute that someone younger steps into power.
Right. So another thing that I've kind of noticed too, and this will probably, we'll talk about a little bit later, but some attitudes on the right, what attitudes do you find most counterproductive? I have one that I'm thinking of, but I want to hear your thoughts first.
Well, I mean, I spent the last week or so battling, you know, the orange chicken, the Panda Express Chipotle management attitude. Yeah. This is one of those scenarios where the American system is obviously got lots of upsides, right? Like I am blessed to be here. This is my country. I love it. And I am never complaining about my position relative to most of the world. That said, it is very clear that there were a number of decisions made by older generations, especially the boomers, to kind of mortgage the future of the country and young people. And they have created a scenario in which, while the life of young people is not terrible, they're not starving in the streets for the most part, anything like that, there is a noticeable decline in the ability to start families, create these, you know, these kind of situations. And you know, one of the first videos I ever made on my YouTube channel was the Ben Shapiro paradox, where you have a guy who talks a lot about the importance of family values and the need for, be religious and build community. And then is also like, by the way, if a company gets rid of your job, then just move across the country. Like, well, what about the community I just built? What about the roots? What about the tradition? What about the identity? How am I supposed to start a family when me and my wife both have to work, 60 or 70 hours a week managing Chipotle's in order to, to buy a house if we're very, very lucky? Like, conservatives can't talk about the value of religion and family and community and all these things and then just, sell the seed corn, for an extra cruise. And so that's really a pet peeve of mine, which is why I kind of went so hard in the paint when I saw that attitude coming up. Like, I think a lot of it was just a reflex action, because a lot of these guys were millennials. Like, they weren't even boomers, but they were repeating the old conservative line. And I was just like, no, this is done. That's destined. It's dead. Like, if this party wants to talk about families and community, you need to act like it matters. Don't just repeat the old slop you've been doing for the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's kind of like the boomer in spirit thing, right? Where, the saying always is pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And this also kind of touches on, I think, some of the H-1B and immigration conversation as well, where if you would have asked me probably a year ago, I probably would have said that, like, I agree with his position. But then over time, I began to think about it a lot more, and especially as I get older and plan to expand my family and whatnot. I'm like, you know what? I don't think there should be any immigration, because, like you said, right now your average family, the median household income is $82,000 a year, which, like, here in Pennsylvania, that'd be two people making $41,000 a year. You'd be just scraping by, and the cost of living here is low. Like, you can get a pretty decent house for less than $100,000. So Yeah, and like that's awesome. But once again, you want to go anywhere else, much to your point. if you lose your job here, just move somewhere else. Okay, well, my house here is going to sell for $125,000. If I want to move to California, that doesn't even put a down payment on a house.
Yeah, if you're going to move to Florida, you're going to need $250,000-$300,000 exactly. to get into a 2-3 bedroom.
Right. So I started to shift over to the position of like, I don't think we should introduce any more people, legal or illegal, obviously, into the system until we kind of figure out how to kind of make the standard of living for the average American so that they feel like they can have a family comfortably. And like, this is very arbitrary, but I think it's a reasonable thing to say is like, hey, you know what? We got to take care of ourselves before we start saying we can welcome other people here. So to another point, when Vivek kind of criticized American culture, I don't think he was entirely wrong because, you know, there are a lot of people who probably criticize him that would also complain about their participation trophy generation. But at the same time, you know, you just kind of got this very, very nice position in the MAGA movement. And not to mention, you also kind of did a giant rug pull that fucked over a lot of people and made a lot of money yourself. I don't think this criticism necessarily rings very true when it comes from you. So, what were your thoughts when that kind of debate broke out?
Yeah, I mean, so obviously it would be better if American education wasn't garbage, right? And we actually taught kids stuff and they were competitive. The problem with Vivek's post was manyfold. The first one is that he set this false dichotomy between the nerds and the jocks. That was just a lie, right? Like, oh, American culture only celebrates the cheerleader and the football player. Like, dude, what are you observing? Like, right. It's been Revenge of the Nerds my entire life. And I say that as a nerd, Marvel movies are the most popular genre of entertainment. The idea that, every TV show is denigrating the jock. They're the bad guy. Well turned out, beautiful, physically impressive people. They're the problem. They're always the evil. And it's always like, the deformed mutant who plays enough D&D. Like, and I've played D&D. I'm not knocking anybody, but these are the archetypes that get played out on television, right? Like that's the culture that you're looking at. So like, first, this is just a dead archetype. Like this is not true. Second, his response was like, well, you need to be grinding, 80, 90 hours a week. No socializing. You should be doing more spelling bees and more, more math camp. And again, like, should you be reading Shakespeare instead of, watching your ninth football game? Yeah, sure. Yeah. Like I'm with you there. I would prefer some more high culture inside the United States. But his attitude was the Tiger Mom attitude, right? This is the one that has produced South Korea. Now, good news, South Korea's, make some nice money. They do some, some nice have some nice, tech industry stuff. Guess what? They're also dying. Like their kids go to school all day. They do prep all day. Their people work all day. They don't have any children. The birth rate is lower than it is in North Korea. Like that's how bad it is in South Korea. They're making money, right? But they're like destroying their civilization in the meantime. Also, you look at a lot of these Asian cultures where people are working that much and they can't innovate. Like, yes, they can iterate. They can produce, they can copy at a high rate, but they have a difficult time creating new things, right? And that's because burning yourself out all the time actually destroys your ability to be creative, to grow and build in particular ways. Maybe that's the best thing for them. Maybe that's the way that those countries should be run. Maybe that's what success looks like for them. But it's not what success looks like for America. America is known for its Protestant work ethic. Like that's literally the thing that is acknowledged as a widely influential on how America got here. But that was never a work every single moment of the day situation. And if you look at people's mental health and the way that young people are handling things right now, the problem is that they get less socialization, that they have fewer friends, that they aren't meeting romantic partners. Again, you want families? Okay, well, you can't tell everyone to work 90 hours a week. Like, that's actually not the way to build civilization. And finally, Vivek said, oh, and by the way, I got ahead because all the immigrant communities didn't do that. Mm-hmm. So what he's saying is my culture is better than your culture. He's not talking to you as an American. He is specifically saying, actually, I had a different culture from you because I came from a different place from you. And that's why I am better than you. I mean, a lot of people are like, oh, he's just giving Americans what they need to hear. No, he's telling them to be like him. And he's saying, I had a different culture, and that's the way you should be. Sorry, but you don't get to say that to people. You don't get to do the tough love when you come from the outside, right? The tough love comes from the people inside. Like the coach, the parent, the teacher who has poured into you, they're the one who gets to say, look, man, you got to pull it together, Kyle. You got to start paying attention. You know, I love you. You know, I'd do anything for you, but I need you to work harder, right? Like, that's where that authority comes from. You don't get to come from another culture and say, oh, by the way, my culture is just superior to you, and I'm going to give you the tough love speech. Like, no, man, go back. Like, pack it up, get in the locker. Like, sorry, we're not doing that. You can be American or you cannot, but you can't tell me, oh, well, my immigrant culture is better than your American culture, but I'm also American. Like, you got to pick a lane, man. It's got to be one or the other. And especially when you're not acknowledging the DEI stuff, you know, the way that, you know, native born Americans have been pushed out of their own economy, their own education, their own job opportunities. We don't mention any of that in your speech. Then you're basically saying, oh, well, I know you've been, you know, basically shackled to the floor, but I'm running around you. I'm just so much better. My culture is so much better. Actually, it's illegal for my company to hire too many people who look like me, because they can hire all the people they want that look like you. That's literally the law of the land in the United States. So maybe it's not the spirit of your culture. Maybe you get a break because the laws are literally tilted in your favor.
Right. And much to that point, it's funny when people, you know, you see these grind set people on YouTube, and like, I'm all for telling people, hey, man, you could do much better if you just put in a little bit more effort, because, you know, to be honest, we all could put in a little bit more effort in a lot of things. But that being said, when you hear the people saying, oh, I work 80, 90 hours a week or something like that, you're not working that entire time. It's short bursts of intensity. And then, you know, you go do something else, you sit down, you take a shit, you go to the bathroom or something like that, whatever. And then you get back to it. You're not, you know, constantly swinging a hammer for those full 90 hours. I work on cars for a living. There's nobody in my shop that is just 100% at it at all times. Because like you said, you'll get burned out. And, you know, this is kind of similar, but I remember I had, funny enough, a professor from, I think it was Miami University, Bill Campbell on, who's a hypertrophy researcher, and basically like researches how, like, body composition and how to help people get to, like, basically show prep lean. And him and I talked about a study where they basically had people resistance train consistently over the course of, like, I think it was 6 months, right? And then the other group did like 3 weeks on, 3 weeks off, 3 weeks on, 3 weeks off. And funny enough, by the end of the study, both groups, even though one person, or, you know, one group trained like 50% less, and I may not have these details perfectly, but the point's overall correct. The group that took like 50% of the time off, they were still at about the same place that the other group was that consistently worked out. So, like I said, to that point, or like to your point, if you just sit there and grind 100% of the time, eventually you're going to burn out. And then, you know, what you produce isn't going to be worth the time that you're getting. There's diminishing returns.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, like, one of the reasons I am where I am now is I basically replace all of my casual reading, TV watching, and video game playing with reading political theory. Like, that's all I did. I was like, all right, if, you know, if I was going to read a sci-fi book, or, you know, sit down and spend, you know, 2 hours on a video game, instead I am reading, you know, books, I'm taking notes, I'm writing things, I'm making YouTube videos. That's how I spent my time. Like, to the point where now it's kind of a problem because I don't have hobbies. Like my hobbies are now my job. Like, they're the same thing. It's like, oh, I got a day off. What am I going to do? Oh, I've been trying to get through that, you know, that other, you know, Plato's laws or whatever. I guess I should probably be, you know, like that. So like, but ultimately, so I'm not saying don't work hard. Like, obviously, you know, that I am where I am in part because I worked hard, but you can't do that all the time. Like, you have to live a life. You have to leave space for, you know, God and family and regeneration. Like, you have to, because if you don't, you're just going to fall apart. And like I said, most people are just not, you know, people who tell you they're working 70, 80 hours a week, they're just lying. They're just lying. They're sitting on their phone. Like, that's what they're sitting at their phone on the clock. Like, that's what they're really doing. Like, somewhere, you know, I've had three jobs, you know, going through college. I've worked lots of shift, you know, at work and all that stuff. I've put in lots of time, but you can't do it for long. Like, you know, eventually you will just burn out. The candle at both ends thing just doesn't work. And it certainly keeps you from having a richer life. Like, work isn't there just for the sake of work. It's there because it improves your life and the life of your children. Like, that's the reason the, you know, immigrant burns 80 hours a week at work is so that the kids don't have to, not so that they can secure a future of 80 hour work weeks for their children in perpetuity. That work was made for man, not the other way around. And people have to, you know, treat it that way.
Yeah. So one other thing that I was kind of curious about from your perspective is the whole immigration conversation as a whole. So, and I think this kind of goes to also something else I want to talk about, which would be like libertarianism and all that. But let's kind of start with the immigration stuff. Were you always more on like the immigration restrictionist side, if that's the proper phrasing, or did you kind of change your mind over time about it?
You know, I'm in South Florida, so obviously large amounts of Hispanic immigrants. That's always been a big part of it. I would teach, you know, high school and stuff. You know, half the kids are, you know, are bilingual, and many of them are monolingual only in Spanish. You know, like, this has always been a part of my life. So I, you know, I've never been in the scenario where I wasn't interacting with many different cultures and immigrants and this kind of thing. I have, you know, lots of friends who are immigrants who contribute to society and do amazing things, and I'm happy to know them, that kind of thing. But I always thought that it was very strange that we were kind of dedicating the amount of time that we were and resources we were to taking care of people who weren't here legally, at least, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, being a teacher, I knew specifically like the amount of time and resources that were going to basically make the class worse so that people who couldn't speak the language or understand the culture could get anything out of it. And for the most part, they still weren't getting anything out of it, and they were just getting handed C's and being promoted through the system anyway. And so that was always kind of in the back of my mind. But the thing that really red-pilled me on this was the immigration crisis in Europe. When I saw the, you know, Middle Eastern summer, you know, and everything that kind of happened from that, the spring rather, and kind of the waves of immigration that came to Europe, and the amount of violence and the way in which like their social systems were overrun and everything, I was like, why aren't people pushing back? Why are people allowing this in their country? Like, women are being raped and assaulted and killed, and like, they're just not doing anything. And that triggered me to say, well, is this popular anywhere? And so I started looking at the numbers, and it turned out actually both on the left and the right, immigration, both legal and illegal, has been unpopular basically for the entirety of America's existence. Like, from the minute they were able to gather data on this kind of thing up till about 10 years ago, everyone hated both legal and legal immigration. Obviously, even like, you know, the pro-labor left hated.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Because it drove down wages. The right hated it because they were more nativist, which is not a slur, by the way. You should actually care about the native people of your country. But like, you know, everyone was against this. And so I'm like, well, if everyone doesn't like this, and I live in a democracy where you listen to the voice of the people, why are both the Republicans and the Democrats on board with this? Like, every once in a while, the right will be like, yeah, maybe we should do something about the border. But ultimately, like, they really just wanted the cheap labor for the, you know, for the companies they didn't care. And that's really, honestly, you know, everybody's kind of got their red pill thing. And there are other things that kind of pushed me along. But that was really my first switch, was kind of like, why is this thing terrible for a country, really unpopular with everyone in the political spectrum, and yet it gets pushed by both major political parties? And that's where, you know, I really became a restrictionist across the board, because, you know, if you care about the country at all, it's just suicide for your nation.
Yeah, I agree. And we were kind of touching on it earlier, but, you know, it is absolutely insane to think that, like, the whole great replacement thing, as much as people want to hand wave about that, I mean, it legitimately is a thing when you think about, you know, our birth rates here collapsing, people can't afford to have families, and they're literally bringing in millions of people at a time who work for cheaper and don't really understand or keep up with the culture. And to me, it really, I don't necessarily know if there was like a specific moment for me, but just kind of thinking about it more and more, it's like, well, why aren't we prioritizing Americans? And like, why do we insist on immigration? And, you know, why is this even like a conversation when, like I said, we should be prioritizing American families and kind of make sure that like the average American can replace themselves if they want, as in like, you know, have kids, you know, a wife, if she wants to, could stay at home. And you don't ever hear people saying like, ah, you know, I just can't afford to have kids, because I think that's where a lot of people are at. And I think that's why people are choosing to have kids later and later and later. And people kind of look at kids as more of like a commodity rather than something that's like going to make their life and everything about, you know, their family and their community better. And I think we're in a really, really detrimental place when you start looking at people that way.
Yeah, you know, Oswald Spengler said that once the question of having children is a question rather than a normal rhythm of life, that's kind of the end of your civilization. Like that's when you're kind of screwed, because like the normal life cycle of a human being involves children. Like that, it is just the way that you have always existed. But you know, we have modern contraceptives that can, you know, switch that off, but that's actually not that new. Like Rome had this, you know, that was one of their downfalls. And so actually what we see is a cycle, you know, that is not particularly modern, even though we've modernized it, in which once societies kind of fall out of this rhythm, they always struggle to get back. Right. And we even see this with some of the, like I think it's either Norway or Denmark, where they were pushing very hard to incentivize births, and you know, Hungary does this, I think, where they, like, you know, after the fourth child or something, you don't pay taxes anymore. And it works a little bit, it makes some improvement, but you know, this is a problem that affects all of modernity. It is bad in the United States, but it is bad all over, to be fair. And I actually believe that ultimately modernity is the great filter. Like actually, the morphological life cycle of civilizations kind of repeats itself in this way. Like once you get advanced enough, you just kind of stop producing yourself anymore. But ultimately it is incredibly foolish to think that you're going to outrun this problem with immigrants. Only one, because it's failed every time it's been tried, including Rome. Two, because immigrants become American and have fewer children faster than they replace themselves. So not only are you destroying your culture and limiting opportunities for your native population, but your Ponzi scheme doesn't work either, because actually these people just adopt, even if they did adopt the other parts of your culture, they adopt the thing where they don't have as many kids. And so ultimately you're kind of dooming yourself all across the board. So it really makes sense if for no other reason than it's just failed every time that it's been tried, that you would at least kind of favor your own civilization more. You know, your residents should be the ones who are receiving the priority when it comes to the ability, like you said, to have children, grow families, receive opportunities. And the people who are lucky enough to kind of join that should be incredibly grateful. But that should not be any kind of solution to the problem of, you know, kind of your welfare system or anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one thing that I've thought about quite a bit has been like this idea of progress, because obviously, you know, the fact that we do have significantly less deaths from just climate overall is a good thing. The fact that we do have labor saving devices is a good thing. Like there are a lot of great things that came from the Industrial Revolution and from European whites who brought up the living standard of the entire world. But at the same time, that did come with the cost of kind of what we're talking about here, is like a reduced birth rate and people starting to look at having families as a different thing. So that kind of led me to the question, like, okay, well, is there like a happy medium here? Or like, what the hell can we do about this? Because it doesn't seem like we're not going back, right? As in, you can't get rid of all this technology. Like these, we're going to have to learn how to live with these smartphones. When it comes to like health and stuff like that, we're going to have to learn how to live with hyperpalatable foods. We have to learn to live with this stuff. but you know, it doesn't seem like we've figured out how to learn to live with it, and like we've learned how to live with it and still continue on as a culture, and not necessarily as a species. I mean, there's still gonna be plenty of people on this planet, but you know, birth rates in are just way down and people aren't really concerned about having kids. So what do you think about this idea of like progress and the fact that like as we get more advanced, people look at having families differently?
I don't really believe in progress. I think that there are no solutions, only trade-offs.
Sure.
And so you solve problems through technology, but you usually create as many, if not more, problems when you create it. And I don't say that to be a Luddite. I am skeptical that humans have the ability to stop themselves. You know, we all have spent our entire lives consuming media about the dangers of AI, right? Like, literally, you know, the first science fiction novel is Frankenstein, right? It's the what terrible thing happens when science is unleashed, right? And from there, we've got the Terminator and everything else that we grew up on. And yet, here we are, you know, building AI as fast as we can, gain of function research, which is just insane, right? Like, you know, the people who are doing it should be redacted, you know, like it's insane. And yet I don't know that we can really stop ourselves. You know, I think that there is that this is kind of the tragedy of the human condition. And so in some ways, I think it's wise to recognize this truth. As you say, these things are going to be created. They're going to, we're going to have to live with them. The only way out is through, you know. But I think what we are seeing right now above anything else is a shift in selection, right? Like we're going through a filter, and, you know, previously the filter was like disease or sufficient calories or war. But now the filter is self-denial, right? The filter is, do you embrace the metaphysics of the washing machine, to use Dugan's example? Like, do you have to embrace every piece of technology, no matter its consequences, simply because it's there? Or, you know, do you have to embrace every high caloric food? Do you have to embrace every dopamine trap on your phone? Like, or are you able to tell your kid, no, you can't have the iPad. No, we're not going to McDonald's. No, I don't care, you know, whether or not this will put China ahead. Like, we're just not going to embrace AI. You know, like, can you do that or not? And if you can, perhaps, you will be the one that makes it through the filter. You know, the people who are going to have kids in the coming generations are those that are going to deny themselves many of the modern conveniences and understandings that we have today, the ones that destroy the ability to people to, like, have, you know, children and family formation and everything else. Like, religious people are having kids, man. Like, that's just the truth, right? Like, that's who's making it. You know, and you're going to have a lot more Mormons than you are atheists. No matter how many are being converted. You know, people may not like that. They might think it's backwards. That's nice. You're not going to be, you know, you're not going to be around to care one way or another. And so, you know, I think that's really the thing we have to remember is we may not be able to control all of this. We may not be able to stop it, but we can work on ourselves and our family and our community and help them get through it. And I think that's ultimately, even if we can't have civilizational size solutions, we can have personal and community solutions. And that's probably what's going to be the thing that gets you through it.
All right. Interesting. The other thing I've heard you talk about, and I think this kind of touches on this point as well, is like, there's almost gatekeepers, as I would call them, and the intellectual dark web liberal types, where, you know, your James Lindsay, your Sam Harris, and characters like those, where I think they're kind of seeing the writing on the wall with kind of the incoming Trump phenomena, at least this time around, as in, like, I don't want to say necessarily the return of religion, but like, there are a lot more people going towards, you know, Southern Baptism, you know, Eastern Orthodoxy, or Roman Catholicism, like these, you know, very, very, I don't want to say dated, but very, very old religions. And I think that's for the better. I'm still agnostic, but this is something I battle with a lot because
yeah, we'll get you. Don't worry. It's only a matter of time.
Yeah, you and Hawk are
one of the steps on the pipeline, baby. It's, you know.
But you kind of see these types running around concerned about the return of right-wing fascism and this whole idea of, you know, religious right coming back. But much to your point, you know, these people are still having kids. And, you know, what do these liberal left people, or, you know, who kind of ostensibly put themselves on the right, it's like, what do you guys have to offer in place of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, they're worried that we're going to shatter the post-war liberal consensus, and they're right. They should be. You know, their brand of liberalism is just dead. It's got nothing to offer people. We've seen it play out. The 90s was great. You know, I was a kid in the 90s, loved it, fantastic. But guess what? Like, you can't stay there. It's just not going to be the case. We can't live in that moment forever. You know, to borrow R.R. Reno's phrasing, the strong gods are coming back. The weak gods of economics and ideology, they just can't hold people together anymore. They can't get them through the day. They can't form families. They can't produce children. They can't give people meaning. It's just not enough, man. Like, sorry, like, I don't need a third flat screen TV. I need virtue. You know, like that. That's really what people want. The left was successful in many ways because they were offering people meaning, garbage meaning, but meaning on the less, and identity. And, you know, guys like James and Sam are terrified of identity, right? Because in identity lurks all the things that they worked so hard to bury. And they're right. Identity is scary, right? Like, identity is powerful. It can do evil things, but it can also do amazing things. You know, Rome, you know, was not great. You know, people didn't love Rome because it was great. You know, Rome was great because they loved her, right? Like, this is really what makes a civilization. And ultimately, you have to move beyond that really careful, you know, liberal idea of, you know, we're going to have this minimum viable morality and weak social bonds, and it's all about economic incentives, and people are just machines we can engineer. Like, that's dying, man. That's not working. And so the question of the next 50 years is going to be, who are we, right? And that's a scary question. There's a lot of dangerous things hiding in that question. But if we don't answer it, the left will. It's going to get answered. Like, people will find meaning. They will find identity. And the only question is, what's it going to be? And I would rather it be something, you know, that is, you know, like you said, Southern Baptist or Catholic or Eastern Orthodox, something that is, you know, healthy, stands the test of time, has proven itself to, contribute to human flourishing. And ultimately, I believe to be true, as Christ is, you know, king. But ultimately, these are much, much better identities for us to embrace if we're going to embrace identity. And they're just fighting a losing battle because, you know, one way or another, this is coming. I just think we should pick the right one.
Right. So I guess this pivots over to another topic I really wanted to talk to you about is, would you include libertarianism and even anarcho-capitalism in kind of what you had kind of summed up there as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's always difficult because I really, really hate the term libertarian, as many people know. And I hate it more than I hate conservative, but only barely, because every time I talk to a libertarian, when I point out the problems of left libertarianism, they're like, what are you talking about? Libertarian is awesome. And it's like, okay, man, like, if you guys who have radically different positions could stop calling yourselves the same thing, that'd be great. Like, Hans Hermann Hoppe is a genius who understands, you know, reality way better than, you know, most conservatives. And he is so far away from Bill Maher that it is hilarious. But both of them call themselves libertarians. Sorry, but like, Mises guys and guys dancing on their underwear on stage should not be in the same room ever. Okay. It just shouldn't happen. Like, you're not the same people. You don't have the same values. Just because someone said libertarian at some point doesn't mean you share it. I get you guys want to own the label, whatever, fine. I disagree. But ultimately, it's super frustrating. Like, I got into trouble with libertarians, you know, yesterday because I pointed out that the libertarians were booing. And they're like, what are you talking about? Like, dude, you can hear people booing. Like, a lot of people cheered. Like, yes, they did. And then others booed. But you all call yourself the same thing, so I can't differentiate, right? Like, if I could just say, like, all the, you know, libertarians were booing, that'd be great. But I can't, because you guys keep calling yourselves the same thing, so I don't have the option. And so ultimately, like, I think there is good libertarianism. You know, there is a version of this, like you said, anarcho-capitalism. These things are much closer to do better. I still have serious problems with libertarianism because getting rid of the state is as utopian as getting rid of the profit motive. Like, it, ultimately, you're living in the same kind of ideological, Neverland that communists do, even though you're much better than communists. Because you just can't get rid of the state any more than you can get rid of the family or get rid of, you know, capital. Like, it's just not going to happen. And so I think that, you know, it's better to work inside the reality there. You know, the democracy of the guy that failed is really good for like 2/3 of it when Hoppe is talking about de Juvenal's understanding of power and monarchy. And then he's like, well, maybe we just kind of solve this with like contract law. I'm like, buddy, come on, man. Like, that's, you know, and again, like, he's awesome. Like, I love him. But, you know, there's just some holes in the ideology. So, you know, I've said this many times. I said this to Dave Smith and all kinds of other guys. Like, I love libertarians because they're so close, but they got to get over the, you know, they got to get over the hill. So that's what I'm doing. I'm only chiding you because I love you and I want you to be right. I just want you to be closer to right. You're like way better than the left. It's not even close. Mm-hmm.
So when you said kind of get over the hill there, I think the hill for me and why I still consider myself a libertarian, but more of like a monarch or minarchist libertarian.
Yeah, no. You were right the first time. There you go.
Getting there, maybe. Yeah. It probably is.
Yeah, we're getting the baptism on this stream. Like, we don't even need to wait, man. Like, go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Is that really the abortion issue had always been one that had bothered me when it came to libertarianism, because I do believe that, you know, in the pro-life position, as in, like, I do think it is a fair and just reason for a government to go in and stop people from murdering children. And in a anarcho-capitalist society, there is no way to do that. When it comes to kids, anarcho-capitalism and libertarianism doesn't really have a sufficient explanation or justification to kind of how you should do that. And people say, oh, well, it's a legal theory. Okay, well, you're centering an entire worldview on libertarianism. And any ideology that does not focus on, you know, prospering of children and family, it's kind of doomed, and rightfully so.
Yeah, so one of the problems with libertarianism, and conservatives do this too, like, this is actually a huge problem with conservatism, so this is a shared problem. I'm not just picking on libertarians here. Mm-hmm. They start with liberty, and they think that liberty then leads to a just and orderly society. But that is the opposite order of operations. You start in war, you move to order, then you move to I did an episode on this today. Move to juridical defense. You move to law, and then you get liberty, right? Liberty is the fruit of a ordered and virtuous society, not the other way around. If you give the liberty first without the virtue, you are handing someone self-destruction, right? A heroin addict is not free, no matter if they go to jail for doing heroin or not, right? They are slaves. And so the virtue comes first, and that yields the liberty. One of the problems that libertarians have is they think that, like, you order law correctly and then you get the good society. When actually law is an organic instantiation of a way of being and tradition and culture of a people. So if you have a virtuous people and a rightly ordered, tradition, that will produce the law that then allows for liberty. But if you just start with a legal theory, then it never works. Cause like you're saying, like, it doesn't take into account the critical human elements of actually lived lives, right? Like, the state of nature isn't real. It doesn't exist. You live in societies. Yeah. Meme, you know, like that's the real world. And so, you know, the confusion, it's not that liberty isn't good or that it's not the goal, but if you spoke to any of the ancients, if you look at what liberty means under Aristotle, he's talking about the freedom to do the right thing in an ordered society, a virtuous thing, you know, a virtuous society. That's what it is. It's an ordered liberty. It's not just the ability to, like, get gay married and do drugs. Like, that's not liberty. That's not you. the more virtuous the people are, the more they are in line with a moral vision that allows for the flourishing of their way of life, the less the state needs to exist, which is also why you want less immigration, because you have fewer conflicts of moral vision because people are coming from different cultures, and then the state is the only one who decides. So if you want to shrink the government, then the key is actually rightly ordered civilization, not reducing just the actual number of words in a constitution or a legal code or something.
Right. One thing that has always bothered me as well about my fellow libertarians is when people say you're just Republicans that like to smoke weed, I completely get it. But it's funny because I cannot stand the smell of marijuana. Like, and I think anybody that goes to Atlantic City per se, right? Like Atlantic City, I'm sure used to be nice at one point. My wife and I went there last year in May because she wanted to go see Kelly Clarkson. And, you know, it was a cool little trip. When I'm walking down the boardwalk at, you know, 7:10 in the morning and all I smell is weed and there's homeless people coming up to me, if it makes me not a libertarian to say I think the police should come in and remove those people or tell them you can't be here, I'm okay with that, because I don't think anybody would want their 5-year-old kid to be walking on a boardwalk in a public space and have to see stuff like that. But there are libertarians that will defend it all day, every day. And I don't think that's a defensible thing. I don't think anybody should be chomping at the bit, or, you know, your answer to that just shouldn't be, well, end the state, bro. Okay. Well, let me know how that's going to go. And as soon as you know, I'm all ears. But until then, we have to do something.
Yeah, again, a properly ordered society is going to allow people to exist in a way that is ultimately going to be more freeing, even if it has to restrict certain behaviors. You know, I think like blue laws would actually be great, even though technically it would be the state telling businesses they couldn't operate. Oh, no. But actually, ultimately, it's going to remove the constant need for the state to overregulate economic transactions and so many other things outside of that day, because you'll have strong families, strong communities, people who have virtue, believe in a shared culture, and they will govern themselves more effectively. Again, the founders knew this. They said the Constitution was for a moral and religious people. It was not good for any other, right? It was not going to work. And for some reason, libertarians are like, yeah, they probably didn't mean that. Like, I don't know. Like, they're like, what did they know, right? Yeah, well, we worship them otherwise. But yeah, they probably didn't get that part right. You know, ultimately, I'm with you. I think that there should be restrictions. That doesn't mean I want people spending their lives in jail for smoking weed or something. Yeah. But yeah, like there has to be a certain level of protection for children. There needs to be some guidance. I would ultimately prefer that all of this is done on the personal level. But ironically, you know, being a little more authoritarian on certain issues that unify your culture and inculcate virtue will mean that the rest of your state can actually be less intrusive, because the people will govern themselves and you'll need less legislation to make people functional. They won't have to rely on the state because they'll have functional families and churches and community organizations. So just small amounts of the application of state power will actually reduce the overall need for state power. But if you have this grand unifying theory of the state is always evil, no matter what, that's always the thing that causes the problem, then you're missing the actual forest for the trees.
Yeah, I definitely agree. My buddy Dave from Scarred Thumb, do we need a new Robert E. Lee statue?
Oh, baby, it's coming. We're melting down some George Floyd statues, some, plenty of radical leftist statues are getting reforged into, you know, Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee. Yeah, it's coming.
I like it. So I want to be respectful of your time, but there is one last thing I wanted to hit on. It's going to be a little bit out of left field. I see the two vinyls on your wall. So you have War of Ages, Dominus on the left, and you have Mastodon's Leviathan on the right.
Yes.
Okay.
And so, Striper behind me. Don't forget Striper.
Okay, yeah, that's okay. I couldn't recognize
that's
that.
That's okay. My head's in the way. It's big, you know.
But okay, so what was your introduction to heavy metal?
I probably heard Black Sabbath on the radio when my mom was listening to oldies, because they would drop like War Pigs and stuff in there. I'm like, wow, that sounds much different than the Temptations. This is pretty cool. But I didn't really get, you know, people will laugh, but you know, I'm not just doing the meme here. I am actually a fan. Creed was the first band that I probably like went out and bought my own, you know, with my own. Oh, you got a Creed poster back there somewhere?
That's okay. So that's actually Mark Tremonti. That's his 15-watt amp head.
Oh, nice.
I have the 100-watt edition over at my band's practice space, but and then over there in my pedal bag, I have, if you're familiar with his solo work, but the Dying Machine Tremonti wah pedal.
So. Okay, yeah, no, I'm not familiar with all of the tech. I just enjoy the music. I'm the rare metal fan that never tried to be in a metal band. Though you do a great job, so well done.
Thank you. I appreciate that, man.
But yeah, that was kind of my first introduction to harder music. I know everyone who's an actual metal is laughing at that, but you know, from there I was like, oh, this Metallica stuff. Oh, the new Metallica stuff is okay. Oh, this old Metallica stuff. Actually, this is better. And, you know, and so that kind of, dropped me down the rabbit hole. I've always, particularly enjoyed Christian metal, you know, kind of gone out of my way to enjoy that. War of Ages is great, you know, for that, along with Stryper. But metal in general has always just been something I've really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. So I listened to you and Pete's show on A Heavy Metal Christmas, and
oh, that was so bad. I forgot every single metal band. It was so bad. I embarrassed myself so terribly. Like, I don't know what happened. It's like I walked into that show and just immediately forgot everything about metal. But it was still fun to talk about it, of course.
Yeah. Those shows are the worst, where you kind of go in and just all of a sudden everything's just gone out of your mind. And you guys talked about Black Label Society. I put on my Black Label Society hoodie, and you guys were talking about Pantera, and Pantera is my number one favorite band in the world. Like, I believe Pantera, and I will die on this hill 100 times out of 100. I do believe Pantera was the greatest band to ever walk the earth, because just, you can't watch 1991 Pantera in Moscow and not just be like, all right, nobody ever did that before.
Yeah.
So you said your favorite album was Vulgar Display of Power. And it was kind of interesting, because you guys also were kind of dancing around saying most people say Great Southern Trendkill. And maybe this makes me the normie, but my favorite would definitely be Far Beyond Driven.
Fair enough. I mean, I've never quite jived with Far Beyond Driven. Of course, it's an amazing album. I'm not, yeah. But I've actually, I would literally probably, I play Reinventing the Steel more often than I play Far Beyond Driven.
Okay.
You know, Cowboys from Hell is probably my second favorite Pantera album. Mm-hmm. And I really like Down. I listen to Down almost as much as I listen to Pantera. I've always been a big fan of Crowbar and Corrosion. And so, really enjoyed it. I tend to be more of a power metal guy than a groove metal guy. But certainly, you know, Pantera is amazing. Like, if anybody who's, you know, I don't think I've ever run into anyone who's even mildly fond of metal who's like, yeah, Pantera is just not my thing.
Sure. So what were your thoughts on kind of like the new wave of American heavy metal? So War of Ages would kind of be like loosely associated with that. But when I think about this, I think more of like 1998 to like 2007. So we're talking Killswitch Engage, Trivium, Bull for My Valentine, God Forbid, Shadows Fall, bands like Lamb of God, even bands like those. What was your thought on that kind of era of metal?
You know, I wasn't listening to a ton of metal at that time, and so I've kind of backfilled that. I like All That Remains. I know Phil now. We're, you know, friendly with Phil and everything. Really enjoy a lot of that music. But honestly, I don't know all of the bands at that time. I've listened to a lot of Killswitch. I've listened to a lot of All That Remains, Lamb of God and such. If you were like quizzing me about like all the metalcore scene and kind of that kind of stuff at that time, I wouldn't know every band. I wouldn't have a deep dive. I've got a much better chance of, guessing any given like Blind Guardian song, than I do necessarily those bands.
Gotcha. So what was your first concert that you ever went to?
Oh boy. First concert I ever went to, it was probably, I would imagine it was Audio Adrenaline. Again, a lot of Christian music as a kid, especially. Mm-hmm. So, I remember, do you know who Phil Keggy is?
No.
You're a guitar player. Okay. So when we're done, you're going to go listen to Phil Keggy. Might be one of the most amazing, acoustic guitar players of all time. And I remember I was going to watch a Christian band called The Cry, at, you know, when I was like a early middle schooler, you know, and he was opening for them, which is just the saddest travesty in the world, because this guy is like light ages, you know, beyond them. Yeah. But he like, you know, just kind of in the middle of like playing this amazing acoustic solo, like flipped the guitar upside down and started playing with his teeth, which I know isn't like, but like at that time I was just like, that's amazing. Like, this is what's going on here. And so, yeah, those are kind of my early, you know, concert. I remember going to Skillet when, you know, they were, nobody had heard of them on the mainstream, and you know, that kind of stuff. So yeah, a lot of Christian metal or and rock early on, where that's where most of my concert going was. But I have seen Black Label. I saw you know Zach like absolutely demolish and Handle of Jack you know, at a small club in Tampa while shredding. So
oh, that's awesome. Okay, so what would be the best metal concert you've ever been to then?
Best metal concert I've ever been to. You know, recently I've gotten to see a lot of bands that I wanted to see on their way, because they're probably doing their last tours. So I finally got to see Maiden. I finally got to see Priest. I got to see Sabaton. They're not on their last tour, but they were touring with Priest. And then I got to see All That Remains along with Megadeth.
Mudvayne.
Yeah, in Mudvayne. I got to say, the Priest concert was probably my favorite. That was pretty amazing. I know it's old. I know it's not the hardest core at this point, but I'm a really big Judas Priest fan. You know, songs like Painkiller and Jawbreaker, like still, like the minute they, you know, the opening riff, I'm just like, yes, turn it up 1,000 times. I want to listen to that all day.
Nice. Did you get to catch Lamb of God and Mastodon when they were touring?
No, but I am catching Mastodon with Periphery and what's the Coheed. They're on tour, and so they're coming into one of my areas here soon. So get to see them. And and of course I got to see Stryper last year.
Nice.
In live for the first time. So that was pretty amazing too. Michael Sweet can still hit every single note live. Nice. Which is amazing, because that guy actually shrieks more than Rob Halford. Like his voice was far more intact than Halford's, and Halford was still pretty amazing for a guy in his 70s.
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of reminds me of like Sammy Hagar's he'll be 80 still touring, and there were like rumors going around saying that he was gonna retire, but then I think I just saw an interview like a day or two ago and he's like, no, I'm still going. I'm like, man, could you imagine being his age? He still looks damn good too for being like 70 years old.
Well, Alice Cooper, I'm gonna be seeing him too. So yeah, oh, nice. Another guy who's still out there on the road somehow. But
yeah. So I seen Metallica tour. No, we went and saw them out in Jersey, and we saw the Pantera Celebration. So it was Friday night was opening up was Mammoth Van Halen, then it was Pantera, and then Metallica, and then Sunday night was Ice Nine Kills, Five Finger Death Punch, and then Metallica. And I'll tell you what, they still played pretty good. And my wife just got home, but I knew she was a keeper when we were walking out of the venue. And I don't know how you'll feel about this, but she never seen Pantera or Metallica before. Oh, no, she saw Pantera because she went and saw them when we went to go see Lamb of God and Pantera here in Pittsburgh. And I was like, all right, so now you've seen Pantera and Metallica. Which one do you like more? And we're walking out and she says Pantera. I was like, all right, you can stay.
How was Modern Pantera? Because that tour is supposed to be coming into Florida, and I wasn't sure whether to pull the trigger or not.
You should. Yeah. Phil sounds better than he has in like the last 10, 15 years. If you saw Down back in like 2014-ish, which you had to have, or, you know, I know he was touring a whole bunch back then. I seen them like twice. They did a tour with Black Label Society. And I remember Phil, I'm like, man, he sounds rough. Like, just does not sound good. And you shared a picture of one of the songs off the Purple EPs. And you could even hear it in the recordings. Like, man, doesn't sound too good. But then I saw them twice. I'm like, you know what? It's not, you know, 1990s Phil, but for the Phil that we've seen over the last 10 years, sounds pretty fucking good.
Nice. Yeah. No, I, unfortunately I just didn't have the money to go to a lot of, you know, metal shows, for a good chunk of my life. And so I didn't, you know, I've never seen Metallica. I haven't been to a ton of shows. You know, I went to a lot when I was young, and then I've been to more now because I've got more money and kind of the flexibility. You know, but I miss those. So like I said, I'm trying to catch all these guys while I still have a chance. You know, I'm rushing around like I got to get Metallica in, I got to get Priest in, I got to get Maiden in, because who knows, they're losing members left and right at this point. So so I definitely want to see, you know, it's only Phil at this point, right? There's no one else.
Phil and Rex.
Oh, Rex. Right. The bassist. Yeah, I'm trying to catch as many of these shows as I can, since so many of these, that's why when Alice Cooper came in, I'm like, I don't care what the tickets cost, like, who knows, like, yeah, he already looks like the Crypt Keeper, you know, it's only a matter of time, so I better get these in.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, I want to be respectful of your time. Oren, I seriously appreciate your time, the conversation, and everything. This was a blast, and you and Hawk are going to keep dragging me in your direction, whether I like it or not, so... why don't you let everybody know where they can find you and support you and potentially get dragged in that direction with me?
Yeah, sure. Like I said, Oren McIntyre Show, it's on YouTube, Rumble, Odyssey. It's on the podcast networks. And of course, it's on The Blaze. And then I've got, you know, obviously it's on everything is at Oren McIntyre for Twitter and Gab and Substack. And then I've got the book, The Total State. It's the audiobook just came out a few weeks ago. So if you don't want to get the paper edition, if you're more of an audiobook guy, you got that option as well. So,
all right. Well, Oren, thank you so much. And everybody else, thank you so much for hanging out. And until next time, take care.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.